Shoreshin Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everyone. This is Bill, and this is our Torah portion commentary on the portion called Masay, or Journeys. This is the concluding Torah portion in the book Bamidbar, or Numbers. It begins in chapter 33, verse 1, and goes through chapter 36, verse 13. Now, this portion begins by describing the stages of the journeys of Israel, from the time they left Egypt until the time they were on the plains of Moab preparing to enter into the land. And so this serves as a historical record, but also as a spiritual example. There were in all 42 encampments. There were 14 before the mission of the spies. There were 20 until the death of Aaron. And there are 38 years between those two events, by the way. And then there are 8 encampments after Aaron's death until the time they arrived at Moab. And all of those 8 encampments were during the 40th year. Now, that there were only 20 encampments in the 38, we'll say, silent years, that is between the mission of the spies and until Aaron's death, that implies that there was a lot of times of rest. There was only 20 camps in 38 years. So it's not like they were moving every day. There was a lot of times they were just in one place. This, even though they were destined to wander the wilderness for a total of 40 years. So I just found that to be kind of interesting, that there was a lot of time where they were just in camp. Now, Nachmanides suggested that Moses was to record all of these places because of the spiritual example or the spiritual secret that are contained in each one of them. Now, to me, it's interesting that there are 42 encampments, and 42 is a significant number for other reasons in Scripture. There are two periods of 42 months in the book of Revelation, and of course, that's when the two witnesses are there, and the last 42 months is when the beast is given power. But perhaps even more interesting than that is that there are 42 generations from Abraham to Messiah. And we see that in Matthew chapter 1, verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And from David until the carrying away into Babylon, 14 generations. And from the carrying away into Babylon until Messiah, 14 generations. And so you add up those three divisions of 14, the total is 42. And interestingly enough, there are three divisions of encampments. Those that from the time they left Egypt until the mission of the spies, from the mission of the spies to the death of Aaron, and then after the death of Aaron until the time they're in Moab. So again, just a footnote, kind of an interesting thing to me. 14, 14, 14 in generations from the time of Abraham until the time of the Messiah. Now in chapter 33, as we begin the Torah portion, in verse 1, it says, these are the Masay, or these are the journeys of the children of Israel under the hand of Moses and Aaron. The Hebrew word for journeys, where we get our Torah portion name, the root word is masah, and it's a departure. It infers breaking camp. So it's implying more than just a short one-day journey. It's actually implying stations or stages of a journey. The root word comes from nasa. Masa is mem samech ayin. The root is nasa, nun samech ayin. And that root word means to pull up a tent pin. And if you're going to pull up the tent pin, that means you're going to start something. It also implies you're going to be traveling to a more appropriate place. I find that interesting because this word nun samech ayin, nasa, is related to nun samech he, nasa, and that word means to prove. It's the term that's used in Genesis chapter 22 when it says that it came to pass that God was to prove Abraham, nasa. So here's what I'm getting at. The relationship between these two words, nasa, nasah, to prove and to pull up a tent pin or to start. It hints, at least as far as I'm concerned, that these journeys, these stations and these stages of this overall journey were intended to prove Israel, to prove them to be the nation that he's called them to be. To prove, I should say, is slightly distinguished from testing. You test people sometimes to see if they're going to do something. You prove people at times to show that they can do something. So anyway, to prove nasa is related to nasa, to start on the journey. So again, these journeys are going to prove Israel. In Deuteronomy 8, verse 1, here's what Moses says. All the commandments which I command you this day shall you be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness in order to humble you, to prove you, nasa, to know what is in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. Now this word nasa is also related to the idea of a miracle, nes. And it's also tied to the idea of raising up something, also pronounced nasa, just spelled differently, nun, shin, aleph. But all of these things are related to prove, to start, a miracle, to raise up. Because what was he doing through these journeys? He was proving them. He was performing miracles on their behalf that he might raise up a nation called Israel. Now in verse 2 it says, and Moses wrote their goings forth by stages at the commandment of the Lord. And so to me, when it says that he does this at the commandment of the Lord, that the Lord commanded him to write these stages of the journey down means that there is more to it than just history. Now, verse 2 repeats the phrase journey and going forth, but in reverse order. Chapter 33, verse 2, and Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord, and these are their journeys according to their goings out. You and I would tend to read over that, not think anything of it. But rabbinical commentary expounds upon this duplication and yet reversal of the order of these phrases. They say that God's purpose in causing them to go forth on a journey was to get them to progress to the next step in his overall plan. In other words, to raise up. He's going to raise them up as a nation, to prove them in order to see the purpose and the destiny of Israel. However, when it phrases it, their journeys according to their goings out, the people only desired the journey because they were tired of the resting place. In other words, they were only ready to move because they were bored. They weren't thinking of the long-term goal. They weren't thinking about being proven or raised up as a people. They were thinking only of the journey, not the destination. Not the destiny, if we can put it that way. They were not focused on the long-term goal of the Creator. So you consider that there are those who have gone forth from mainstream Christianity to come into the Messianic or Hebrew Roots movement. My opinion is some of these people are susceptible to the same kind of mindset that the children of Israel had as far as the journey was concerned. In other words, if the children of Israel were focused just on the journey and not the overall plan, not the destination, the goal, then I'm saying that some who go forth from Christianity into Hebrew Roots are susceptible to that as well. Some are into a change of scenery for the sake of change itself. But the folks who focus on the change of scenery only never focus on the change that needs to occur in them and to them. Another viewpoint on this repetition in verse 2 is it's hinting at the future redemption of Israel, this so-called second exodus, when Israel will journey from exile into the land once again, which is a good point to raise in light of what it says in verse 3 of chapter 33. And they departed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the month, On the morrow after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with a high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians. In other words, if this phrase in verse 2, this duplication of the phrase, is intended to hint at the future redemption, the second Exodus, notice they went out with a high hand and in sight of all the Egyptians. In other words, their departure was public. There was nothing secret about it. There was nothing clandestine about it. It was in public and it was in mass. They left with their oppressors having full knowledge of their departure. There was no ambiguity concerning when they were to leave and how they were to leave. So what that says to me is, if verse 2 of chapter 33 does in fact hint at the future redemption, then number one, it's not going to be a secret departure. Does that then negate the belief in a secretive escape or rapture? Also, if there was no ambiguity about when they were going to leave and how they were going to leave, then I don't believe there's going to be any ambiguity in the future. In other words, I don't believe we need to sit around twiddling our thumbs and wringing our hands over when do we need to leave. I believe if we're that generation, if we're living in that time, when the time comes, we will know. There won't be any doubt about it. And furthermore, to take it into our own hands to leave when we think, well, all I'll say to that is you better make sure you're hearing from him and not your emotions, not your fear, not your anxieties. So once again, if this is hinting at the future redemption, then it will be with full knowledge of the oppressors and there will be no ambiguity about it. We will know when it's going to happen. Now, their departure from Egypt was occurring even as the Egyptians were burying their dead, their firstborn. That's found in verse 4, because in Exodus chapter 12, verse 30, we're told that there was not one house in Egypt where there was not a corpse. So while Israel left with a high hand, Egypt was bent low in humiliation. The tares, if I can use that word, were broken because of their pride that they displayed up until this event. In verse 4, we see that God executed judgments on their gods as well. And now, obviously, he didn't punish idols of wood and stone. He just proved they weren't gods. He punished Egypt by showing all that they trusted in was worthless, and everything they put their confidence in was powerless. And so these idols were eventually made contemptible in the eyes of the Egyptians. Now that's interesting to me because, again, if this is all hinting at a future redemption, then the idols of Egypt will once again be judged. And the idols, you know, even though they may not be wood and stone necessarily, it's what they represent. And so all of those things that people put their trust in today and put their confidence in today will be proven to be worthless and to be powerless and will become contemptible. Judgment means death and humiliation for some, but judgment can mean life for others. In Egypt, he destroyed their future, that is their firstborn, and he destroyed their past, that is their gods. But at the same time that they were being judged, Israel was being released. Israel was finding life and was rejoicing. In the coming redemption, will the pattern repeat itself? Will everything that Egypt believes in, their economy, their military, their philosophy, will all of that be toppled? And when I say Egypt, I'm speaking metaphorically now. But in verse 5, we see that in sharp contrast to this, Israel went from Ramses or Ra's burden, Ramesses, they went from that to Sukkot. And what did they find at Sukkot? That's where Joseph's bones were being, quote unquote, resurrected. He's not going to be left in Egypt, but he's actually going to make the journey with them to the land of Canaan. So once again, for some, judgment means death. It means being brought low. It means humiliation. But for others, it means life. It means resurrection. It means joy. Now, after they left Sukkot, according to verse 7, they still had to go to the place called Pi-Hahiroth, or Mouth of the Gorges, and they had to face the Lord of the North, Baal-Zephon, before the fortress called Migdol. And if these places are to insinuate things for us to glean from, that's very interesting. They're released from Egypt, but they still got to go through the gorges. They've still got to face the Lord of the North, and they still had to be brought through the sea, according to verse 8. On their journey after the sea, they camped at a place called Elim. And at Elim, we see that there were 12 springs of water and there were 70 date palms. Now, there's a lot of different understandings or interpretations, maybe is the better word, of what these things represent. And quite frankly, I'll be honest with you and say, I'm not absolutely certain, but it is interesting to me that there are 12 springs of water and there are 12 tribes. There are 12 sources of water. There are 70 date palms. The date palms produce fruit. Israel had 70 elders, 70 sources of fruit. All of that, the source of water, the source of fruit, in the midst of the wilderness. In verses 16 through 36, there's not really much written in the scriptures about this time, so the details are actually a mystery. So consequently, it's hard to identify the exact route. Here's why I bring that up. Some people believe that the journey took them into Arabia. In fact, Jim and Penny Caldwell are folks who spent quite a lot of time in Saudi Arabia and who've documented why they believe that Israel traversed Arabia. And perhaps that is why not a lot of detail is given about their journeys between the mission of the spies and Aaron's death, those 38 years that seem to be somewhat silent. Now, the Haftarah for this portion does mention the Arava, and it mentions a completely desolate land. In fact, in Jeremiah 2, verse 6, it says, "Neither said they, where is the Lord that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, that led us through the wilderness, through a land of deserts and of pits, through a land of drought and of the shadow of death, through a land that no man passed through and where no man dwelt." So obviously, through a very barren, very desolate area. And this is in that 38-year period where there's not a lot written about it. And again, there's some that speculate, and they offer their evidence as to why it actually might have been in the Arabian desert. Now, verse 18, it mentions the camp at Rithma. Now, this is the camp where they were at the time of the spies' evil report. This is where they left from, which is also called Kadesh in Exodus chapter 13, verse 26, which is to be distinguished from the Kadesh of verse 36, because that's where Miriam died in the 40th year. So Rithma, again, is the camp where they were at the time of the spies' evil report. Rithma alludes to the sin of Lashon Hara, the slander against the land and God's ability to bring them into the land. And the people stayed in this camp, according to Rashi anyway, for 19 years. What's interesting is, at least to me, this camp is the 14th camp since leaving Egypt. Now remember, at the beginning we talked about the generations, the 14, the 14, the 14, from the time of Abraham to the time of Messiah. Well, this is the 14th camp from leaving Egypt. If we began at Adam and we went forward 14 generations, we would come to Eber. He was the 14th from Adam. And that's interesting because his name comes from the root Avar, Ayin Vet Resh. Avar, to cross over. And this is the root word, of course, that gives cause for Avram to be called Ha-Ivri, or the Hebrew. In other words, the word Hebrew, Ivri, comes from Avar or Eber. So I'm just making an observation. The 14th camp, Rithma, is identified with the camp where Israel was when they hearkened unto the evil report of the spies because they slandered the land, they slandered God's ability to bring them into the land. In other words, they were not going to cross over. They were not going to avar. And so the generation of the spies weren't spiritually prepared to cross over. Eber hints at crossing over. Abraham is the one who crossed over. The generation of the spies, they did not reflect the character of their ancestor Abraham, who was a spy of sorts, because he journeyed to a land he didn't know, and it was inhabited by the same people, as a matter of fact, that the generation of the spies were afraid of. From Abraham, we count forward 14 generations later, and that brings us to David. David, the king of Israel, first gained notoriety by slaying a giant. Interestingly enough, the obstacle, or one of the main obstacles, that provoked the evil report at Ritma was, there are Nephilim, there are Anakim, there are giants in the land. In other words, just like they didn't reflect the character of their ancestor Abraham, they did not reflect the character of their descendant David. Now, verse 38, it says that Aaron died in Mount Hor in the 40th year on the first day of Av at the age of 123. Here's why I bring that out. Aaron died at the 33rd encampment. Traditionally, the Messiah died in his 33rd year. Perhaps that means something, perhaps it means nothing at all, but it was just an interesting thing to consider for me. In verses 48 and 9, it says that they pitched camp by the Jordan from Beth Yeshimot to the plains of Shittim. And at this point, of course, they are receiving instructions for when they enter the land, specifically as it relates to dealing with the inhabitants of the land. And this particular camp would correspond, in my view anyway, to Yeshua crossing the Jordan to go up to Jerusalem. If it reveals something, or if it hints at something, I believe it hints at Yeshua crossing the Jordan to go up into Jerusalem specifically. Because remember, Moses is going to be gathered unto his fathers. Joshua is going to lead them. Yehoshua is going to lead them into the land. Yeshua crossed over the Jordan to go up to Jerusalem to deliver us all. Because after he raised Lazarus from the dead, you'll remember that some sought to kill him. And so in John chapter 11, beginning at verse 54, it says, Yeshua therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went into a country near to the wilderness, into a place called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then they sought Yeshua and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple. What do you think? Will he not come to the feast? Now going on to chapter 12, verse 1, it says, Then Yeshua, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. All right, here's my point in all this. Bethany, where Lazarus was located on the eastern slope of the Mount of Olives. Now, according to Luke 19, Yeshua passed through Jericho on his way to Jerusalem at this particular Passover. In fact, in Luke 19, that's when he had dinner with Zacchaeus. The point is, the wilderness city that John 11 says that he went to may likely have been across the Jordan, because Jericho sits right there on the Jordan, on the boundary with present-day Jordan today. So in other words, what I'm getting at is, it's very likely, I think probable, that when, after he raised Lazarus from the dead, and they were seeking to kill him, and he concealed himself for a time in a wilderness city, and from that wilderness city, according to Luke 19, he's going to pass through Jericho on his way to Jerusalem. It seems probable to me that he was across the Jordan in a wilderness city, and then he had to cross over into the land, and then he went up to Jerusalem to destroy the works of the adversary. Why? That we might be restored to the family, that we might be gathered out of all nations, and that we might eventually inherit the land. Verses 50 through 56, Israel receives commands concerning the settlement of the land. In verse 52 and 3 specifically, it says, Then You shall drive out all of those who live in the land from before you, and destroy all their carved images, and destroy all their molded images, and pluck down all their high places. And you shall possess the land and live in it, for I have given you the land to possess it. Notice that to destroy their images and to destroy their high places is not commanded them for any other land, only the land of Canaan, because this is to be the land of their possession. And I believe this is the land that was once called Eden. This is the land that he has deeded to Abraham and to his seed. Now, in Psalm 24, verse 1, a very familiar scripture says, "The earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell in it." But he says, when it comes to the land of Canaan, that's where you smash the idols and the high places, etc. I mean, in other words, consider that Paul, when he was in Athens, he didn't smash the idols. He didn't smash their pagan gods. In fact, in Acts chapter 17, he used the fact that they had an idol dedicated to the unknown God to introduce the one and only God. The point is that they smashed the idols in the land of their possession. Now, one day, it says he will cause every knee to bow and every tongue to confess that he is Lord. But when it comes to the land, he specifically tells them, smash the idols, break down all their carved images, etc. In verse 54, we see that the land is divided by lot, and the larger tribes receive more and the smaller less. Verses 55 and 6, it says, "But if you will not drive out the people of the land from before you, then it will be those of them whom you let remain shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall trouble you in the land in which you live. And it shall be as I thought to do to them, so shall I do to you." In other words, after just telling us the land's going to be divided by lot, and after telling us smash the idols, their molded images, etc., he gives them a stern warning, and he tells them, if you fail to drive these inhabitants out of the land, that's going to ultimately mean that you can't stay in the land, because the land was going to have to be rid not only of their idols, not only of their molded images, but it's going to have to be completely rid of their corruptive influence of the Canaanites themselves. Remember the influence that the women of Midian had upon them. And Moses said, destroy these women who participated in this plot that Balaam hatched that resulted in this sin at Peor. So likewise, the Canaanites are corruptive influence, and if you let them stay, they will destroy you. Their influence will destroy you. Had Pinchas not stayed, the moral plague that these daughters of Midian were complicit in, many more of Israel would have perished. So again, we have something that seems, in our culture anyway, it seems to be very cruel to exterminate an entire people. Nonetheless, holy can't mingle with profane. And I would also add to that, we weren't there. We don't know exactly how vile and how vicious these Canaanites were. But the point is, he told them, you can't coexist with them. Holy can't mingle with profane. And to fail to rid the land of their influence meant that Israel would eventually fall victim to their influence, which indeed happened on many occasions. So to me, what this says, for then and for now, is as his people Israel, we are to be a set apart nation. So you set yourselves apart from them. And if you don't set them apart from you and yourself from them, and I guess I need to interject this, in some cases that doesn't mean necessarily in a physical sense. Most importantly, it means in what you believe, how you act, what you do, what you don't do. But again, separate yourselves from them, separate them from you, because if you don't, they will eventually separate you from them. And what we mean by that is, like Hitler did in the 30s and the 40s. Israel is called to be a holy nation. And when we do not set ourselves apart by choice, Israel is set apart by others. But when they do that, it's not such a good thing. When that happens, Israel has to leave their homes and see enemies occupy their homes. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 30-32, And the Lord, the God of Israel, says, I said indeed, your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever. But now the Lord says, be it far from me. For those who honor me I will honor, and those that think little of me shall be lightly regarded. Behold, the days come when I will cut off your arm and the arm of your father's house, so that no old man shall be in your house. And you shall see an enemy. And the Hebrew word there, by the way, is tsar. You shall see an tsar in my house. What I'm getting at is this. Israel is to be a set-apart nation. And if they do not live up to that mandate to be a set-apart nation for the purpose of being a light to the nations, then they coexist with all these influences, and eventually all these influences overtake them. In this particular case where I read from 1 Samuel, it's in regard to the tabernacle at Shiloh with the priest Eli and his two sons, Hophni and Pinchas. They had fallen down on their duties. They had neglected their obligations to safeguard those things that were holy. And as a result, all this corrupt influence infiltrated God's house to the degree that he says, I'm going to cut your family off and you're going to see an enemy, a tsar, in my house. So all of this goes back to the garden, because Adam, whom I believe was a priest, was told to work the garden and he was told to guard the garden. But he failed in that, because had he been diligent to guard against the corruptive influences, the adversary, the serpent, may never have been in the midst of the garden, and if not in the midst of the garden, never has a conversation with the woman. So consequently, had he guarded, had he been diligent not to coexist with corruptive influences, perhaps he and his wife would have never been exiled from the land. And this theme of working and guarding is going to run throughout the scripture. And the failure to do it, the failure results in Israel doing to itself what the enemy didn't have the ability to do. Going back to what he told them, he says, I'm going to do to you what I had intended to do to them. Why? Because you didn't do what you were supposed to do. You didn't keep your oath. You didn't keep your vow. And he says that these enemies are going to be pricks in your eyes. And the word pricks has the connotation of restraining, like a hedge of pricks, something that would make it very difficult for you to overcome and would cause you to be restrained. You don't want to go through a hedge of pricks because it's going to hurt. So they're going to be pricks in your eyes. They're going to keep you hemmed in and impede your journey as it relates to who you're supposed to be. You're not going to be able to see clearly when pricks are in your eyes. And these people are going to be thorns in your sides. They're going to be a barb. They're going to be something that pierces in order to harass you and to weaken you. And these pricks and these barbs are reminiscent, even though they're different words, they're reminiscent of what the land was going to produce for Adam. Why? Because he failed to guard. It's interesting to consider what the Philistines did to Samson, because he didn't safeguard those things that had been invested in him. Well, they put out his eyes. It's also interesting to consider what the nations were allowed to do to the Messiah on Israel's behalf. They put a crown of thorns on his head, in his eyes, and they pierced his side with a sword. Now, Moses would later warn them of this, and in fact, he predicted their failure and their subsequent exile, because in Deuteronomy chapter 29, beginning at verse 26, he says, they went and served other gods and worshiped them, gods whom they did not know and who had not given them any portion. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land to bring on it all the curses that are written in this book. And the Lord rooted them out of their land in anger and wrath and in great indignation and cast them into another land as it is today. In other words, he just simply told them, even though I've warned you not to, this is exactly what you're going to do, and this is going to be the end result. Besides having the corruptive influence on the people, notice what the Canaanites' influence did to the land itself, because keeping in mind, this land was to be holy. They corrupted the land. So understanding that, how is it they were allowed to be there in Abraham's day? It's the same people, it's just generations before. Apparently, according to the scripture, they had been given a space of time to live there. Genesis 15, verse 13 through 16 says, "And he said to Abram, 'You must surely know that your seed shall be a stranger in a land not theirs, and shall serve them. And they shall afflict them 400 years. And also I will judge that nation whom they shall serve. And afterward they shall come out with great substance. And you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come here again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full.'" Why were the Canaanites allowed to continue in Abraham's day, but not in Joshua's day? It's because apparently the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full, but that cup was full just as Israel was entering into the land. And that's why you can't let them stay. You can't let their influence continue to be here, because if you do, it's going to be a detriment and eventually destruction for you. Now, in chapter 34, we're given the boundaries of the land, and I'm not going to elaborate on that. We'll just say that the boundaries given here are the ones that the Creator has determined. And these boundaries were actually only briefly attained during the reigns of David and Solomon. And some even argue that even then it wasn't completely filled. But only during the Messiah's reign will Israel completely inhabit the borders that the Creator has determined. Now, as we go into chapter 35, we see instructions pertaining to Levitical cities and cities of refuge. We see that there are 48 cities set aside with land attached for all the Levitical families. The cities are going to serve the purposes of, they're going to establish equal dispersion of Levi'im among the other tribes. And these Levites are going to be among the other tribes to labor along with them. But they're also going to be a source of instruction. They're going to be a source of information as it relates to how to live for these other tribes. And it's also going to ensure that they retain their tribal identity by living together in these 48 different cities. Also consider that the Levites depended upon the tithes of the people for their support. So these cities are going to place them in vicinity of the people upon whom they depend for support. So they're going to be right there. In other words, they're not going to all be congregated up in Jerusalem waiting for all these people from the different tribes to come up to Jerusalem to bring these offerings. They're going to be amongst the people so that the people can bring their tithes to the Levites. Now, these cities were to have open land, meaning the land was to have no houses, no vineyards, no farms. They could, however, use this open land for their livestock and other resources. Now, beyond that, there was land that was used for planting and for vineyards. And so, interesting, if you consider the city, the open land, and then the land beyond that, you had an outer, an inner, and an innermost, set up just like the sanctuary in which they were in service to. In verse 6, among those 48 cities, six were set aside as cities of refuge. These, of course, were places of asylum for those who had committed involuntary homicide. They were not intended for those who committed willful and premeditated murder. Not only were they available to the citizens of Israel, but they were also available to the resident aliens. Levitical cities were used for these cities of refuge because there was already a sacred character to these Levitical cities. And, presumably, because these cities were inhabited by men who would be able or should be able to discern between willful acts of murder and accidental acts of manslaughter. If a person killed someone, accidentally or otherwise, an avenger of blood had the right to kill him. So, if he accidentally killed somebody, unless he fled to a city of refuge, this avenger of blood could come and kill him and nothing would be done. It's possible that a person could be the reason someone died, but that person might not be worthy of death themselves. It may have been an accident, thus the city of refuge. A court would later decide the person's fate, whether he was guilty of willful murder or whether it was an accident. But in the meantime, he needs to be in a city of refuge. And Scripture gives us the names of these six cities. They were Bezer, Ramot, Golan, Kedesh of Galilee, Shechem, and Kiryat Arba, which is also Hebron. Now, verse 8, it was instructed that the tribes who have more cities, that is, the larger tribes, should assign more to the Levites than the smaller tribes. And so, consequently, east of the Jordan, there were 10 Levitical cities. And we're not talking about the cities of refuge here. There were 10 Levitical cities, and in Canaan, there were 38 Levitical cities. And just a footnote to that, in Yeshua's day, there was a region called Decapolis, and it was beyond the Jordan on the eastern side, and Decapolis means 10 cities. However, it's not the same as the Levitical cities. That's just kind of a point of interest. Another interesting footnote, which has really nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it has interest to me, or it's of interest to me, is that the Cherokee tribes of North America had cities of refuge as well. And there's a lot of speculation as to why they had these cities of refuge. We don't have time to develop this here, of course, but we do have a teaching called America, God's End Time Vineyard, in which we elaborate on the Cherokee society and comparing that to ancient Israeli society. And not only do we see do they have cities of refuge, but they had a lot of other common points with ancient Israelite custom as well. So just a footnote. Now, verse 12, these cities shall be for refuge from the avenger. And the word avenger here is goel, which is often rendered redeemer. Now, a lot of other places, when we see this avenger of blood, it will be rendered goel hadam, the avenger of blood. So it's interesting to consider, and here's the point. Goel means redeemer, but the redeemer is also the avenger of blood. Because Goel, when we think of Goel redeemer, a lot of times we'll think of Boaz, who is the kinsman redeemer, who is a type of the Messiah, which is true. But Goel is also the avenger of blood. So the redeemer is the avenger. The Redeemer Yeshua comes as an avenger of the blood of his kinsmen. We read in Isaiah 63, "Who is this who comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This one adored in his clothing, bending down in his great power. I who speak in righteousness, great to save. Why is your clothing red and your garments like one who treads in the winepress? I have trodden the winepress alone. And of the peoples there was no man with me, for I will tread them in my anger and trample them in my fury, and their blood will be sprinkled on my garments, and I will stain all my clothing, for the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come." Where does this avenger come from? He comes from Edom or Edom. Why? Because Edom has shed the blood of Jacob, according to Ezekiel chapter 35, verse 5. In verse 15, we see that the cities of refuge were for all people, including the resident alien and the temporary resident, and of course the citizens, but only for those who committed accidental acts. And the Levitical cities of refuge should not be confused with the asylums that history teaches us of in Rome and in Greece, because these asylums in the Roman Greco world were breeding grounds for criminals. In the days of Tiberius, for instance, crime was so rampant that the asylum had to be limited to a small number. They had to be, many of them, shut down because, again, it was in these asylums where all this crime was emanating from. The medieval church gave sanctuary to criminals as well. And these shrines that the medieval church set aside as sanctuaries were inhabited by vicious criminals. The Torah actually forbids sanctuary for willful murderers. In Exodus 21, verse 14, we see, "But if a man comes presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, you shall take him from my altar that he may die." So again, the Western world gave asylum to all kinds of people, willful murderers, all types of criminals, along, I would assume, with people who had committed acts that were accidental. But these asylums became breeding grounds for crime. And we see it in the Middle Ages as well. The Torah is against that. The Torah says, don't do that. Here's why I find this very interesting. Consider today that in America, there are cities such as San Francisco that are sanctuary cities. They offer asylum to illegal aliens, for instance. But what we see developing is they are becoming a haven for criminals of every nationality and every type. It just shows you once again that we're not smarter than the Creator. There is a reason He tells us to do things. And His reasons are not cruel. His reasons for limiting these things to accidental acts and not for willful murderers, the willful murderers are to be taken out and executed, is because if you allow that kind of an influence to remain, it will eventually kill you. In verses 16 through 18, the Torah specifies who is a murderer. It is someone who has struck the other with an instrument of iron, an instrument of stone or a stone, a weapon that is made from wood, or someone who has hurled something at the victim or thrust at him, in other words, pushed him off a cliff or off the roof of a house or something like that. In other words, the weapon proves the person is a murderer and is to be put to death, because he wouldn't pick up a stone and hit somebody with it on accident. He wouldn't take a weapon of wood or an instrument of iron and strike him with it accidentally. He wouldn't push him off the roof of a house accidentally. So if he's done those things, he is a murderer. Now, Tubal Cain was the first to develop weapons, instruments of iron and brass. And of course, Tubal Cain is a descendant of Cain. And we believe that he is developing these weapons at the very beginning to be used against the righteous seed. Tradition says, or one tradition says, that Cain struck Abel with a stone, and he was a murderer. The Torah also makes distinction about those who lie in wait and those who act without enmity. In other words, if you're lying in wait, you are planning on killing this person or hurting this person. And then there are those who act without any hostility. In verse 19, it says, "The avenger of blood, Goel Hadam, shall put the murderer to death." If this person commits a murder and kills somebody and he runs to a city of refuge and it is found that he used these instruments or he pushed or he thrust at him, what have you, and he's determined to be a murderer, that is the avenger of blood himself who will put the murderer to death in the city of refuge. But now in verse 25, if a person is found not to be worthy of death, if it was an accident, he remains in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But until that time, he must live in the city of refuge. While he's there, he's safe. But if he ventures out of the city, that makes him vulnerable to the avenger of blood. And were he to venture out of the city of refuge after having been found not worthy of death, and the avenger slays him, the avenger is without any kind of blood guilt. If you accidentally killed somebody, you went to the city of refuge, the court found you not to be worthy of death, you're going to have to stay put unless you want to take your life into your hands. Now, at the death of the high priest, then the person, the slayer, the one who's been living in the city of refuge, then he may return to the land of his possession. And if the avenger did something then, there would be blood guilt. Because he's to stay there until the death of the high priest makes the duration of his exile a matter that is left in the hands of God. In other words, the high priest's death is going to come when God determines it. So if that person is having to live in exile until the high priest's death, then his exile is left in the hands of God. Because in that day, the death of a high priest would have been of national consequence. You know, it would be similar to if the president were to die or if an elder statesman were to die, etc. It would have a great impact on the nation. The asylum that was offered by the cities of refuge were connected with the altar of the sanctuary. So the death of the priest, instead of the king, is the one that determines the slayer's term of exile. Now, as we continue in chapter 35, we have regulations concerning murder. In some ancient cultures, murder could be compensated with execution of any member of the murderer's family. In other words, if he murdered your brother and you wanted to go exact revenge and the murderer is not found, well, you could murder his sister or his brother or his cousin, what have you. But the Torah makes it clear that only the murderer is to forfeit his life. An innocent person is not to pay that penalty for someone else's sin. Furthermore, the Torah makes it clear that the loss of life cannot be atoned for with the payment of money. Not even the unintentional killer can ransom himself from the city of refuge. In verse 30 we see, "The murderer shall be slain at the mouth of witnesses, but one witness shall not testify against any person that he die." In other words, there just has to be two or more witnesses. In verse 31, "You shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer or for the release of the unintentional killer. Because if you do that, then the land is polluted with innocent blood." Verse 33 and 4 of chapter 35, it says, "So you shall not defile the land in which you are, for blood defiles the land. And the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed in it except by the blood of him that shed it. So do not defile the land which you shall inhabit, in which I dwell. For I, the Lord, dwell among the sons of Israel." Verse 33, the word defile comes from the root word chanaf, and that means to act wickedly, to be profane, or to pollute. Meaning, if you were able to ransom a murderer with money, or if you were able to reduce your exile by money, that would cheapen a human life. And when human life is cheap, then consequently human life is going to be taken time and time again, and the land is going to be completely corrupt. In the days of Noah, the earth was corrupt before God and filled with violence, according to chapter 6, verse 11. That word violence, by the way, is the word Hamas. And Hamas hints that innocent blood was being shed and consequently polluting the land till the whole earth was corrupt before God. So considering that innocent blood pollutes the land and can only be atoned for by the guilty party, consider the state of our land right now with all the murder, with all the abortion, and all the things that are going on. If the land became polluted with innocent blood, that is the land that the Lord dwelt in, it would in effect cause God to dwell among the contamination. And eventually, he's not going to stick around. And so that would mean that if the land become polluted, eventually his shekinah, his presence, would depart. And if his presence departs, does that not open the door for all of Israel's enemies to come in? Now, if his presence had once been amongst us as a nation, at what point does he leave, or has he left? At what point does it mean for us, ikavod? Because the land is corrupted with innocent blood. Now, as we come toward the end of this Torah portion, previously there were daughters of men who had no sons, but these daughters were allowed to inherit the lands of their father. And so because of that, fear arose that if those particular daughters married men from a different tribe, the lands that had been allotted to the one tribe through the father of these daughters would pass to another tribe upon their marrying another man of another tribe. So in verse 4 of chapter 36, an argument is raised where this transfer through this marriage would become permanent in the Jubilee, because the Jubilee provided for return of purchased land, but not inherited land. And so the land that belonged to the daughters of Zelophehad, if they were to marry men from other tribes, would be outside the provisions of return, meaning that when the Jubilee came, that these lands were to be lost forever to the tribe that should have had them and should have been able to hold on to them. And it couldn't be atoned for with the payment of money. So this issue was raised by the chiefs of Machir of Gilead, who were from the tribe of Manasseh. And when they raised this scenario, Moses makes the declaration that they're right in their argument. Now, again, going back to something we brought up in a previous Torah portion, I don't believe that this particular point escaped the attention of the Creator. I just believe it was one of those things that he knew was there, and the people, as they're growing in the Torah and they're learning to appropriate it into their lives, what is it doing? It's provoking them to think things through. And so as they thought this through, they raised this issue. If the daughters of Zelophehad marry a different tribesman, then those lands that should have been part of our tribe after the Jubilee are going to be forever lost. And this is something that needs to be dealt with. So Moses makes it clear that the sons of Machir are right in their argument. And so then the determination or the law was passed or made that the daughters of Zelophehad or any other woman who had inherited the land of her father because her father had no sons, they could marry anybody they wanted to as long as they were from the same tribe. And so this would ensure that the lands would not pass from one tribe to another. Because he says, the children of Israel shall cleave each one to his own inheritance, indicating that the Creator's wishes are that the allotments that are given to the tribes are permanent. So might this suggest that we are to be who we are and not be conformed to another tribe? If it was so important that the lands that were allotted to Manasseh, for instance, be retained among Manasseh for all time, if the daughters of Zelophehad were to marry only within their own tribe to retain identity and inheritance, if it that was important then, doesn't it stand to reason it's important now, and that we should be who we are and not be conformed to another tribe? And what I mean by that, I'm not trying to be Jewish. As I follow the Torah, it's not about me being Jewish if I'm not Jewish. It's about me being who I am. If I, in Messiah, am part of this family called Israel, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm to conform to being Jewish. And I say that because there are a lot of people who come into this who go that route. They're not Jewish, but they're conforming to the Jewish identity. And with all due respect to our Jewish brethren, it's not about me being Jewish. It's about me being who I am in Messiah and retaining that identity, not my heritage of the flesh, but my identity in Him as part of this family called Israel, so that everybody is who they're supposed to be, playing their role in the overall big picture here. Now, maybe you don't make the connection to that like I did, but it just jumped out at me that if everyone is to cleave to his own inheritance, and he's speaking to the tribes, that I believe that's true for us today, that I'm not to conform to the heritage of a different tribe. I'm to be who I am in Messiah. And so with that, we come to the end of this Torah portion. We come to the end of the book Bamidbar. Thank you for joining us. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.